I'm Linda Pelagio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, everybody, welcome. Food Talk here. Mike Colomeco, your host. Got a great show today. We're going to jump right into it in a second because we have three guests again, so three segments to do. So I don't want to waste too much time. Just want to give a great shout out to a couple of things that happened this week. Great Napa event, wine tasting. I went to Tuesday morning at the Wine Disciples, kind of a brand new restaurant and wine store next door to a great concept on 29th Street off between 6th and 7th. And Laura Maniac, who is a master somm and who's just brilliant, was the host. We did with it. We met with three small Napa producers, vintners, like families that have been there a while. It was great. I don't drink enough California juice, so it was great to have a chance to bore down with people that actually do that for a living and have done that for a couple of generations. And of course, Laura, who's just a genius, had a lunch afterwards drinking those same wines. That was great. Then later that day, wine still was happening. Pascaline LePeltier, anytime she's doing anything, I fly. So Pascaline was doing a Loire Valley tasting at the Manhattan Wine Company, which is a great store, actually. If you've never heard of it, it's great. It's over there in Hudson Yards, 29th Street, right off of 11th, between 11th and West End, or West Side Highway. But anyway, Pascaline, Loire Valley, that's where she's from. She's a master somm. She's absolutely brilliant. What a great night. That was super, super, super. Had a great dinner at Il Gatto Pardo last night. And I'm forgetting something that I did in between. It was a great week for eating around town. I'll get into that next week maybe or something. Anyway, we got to tour Bouchon Bakery today too. I want to have the pastry chef, Alessandro Altieri, on this show. I think it's next week. But today's show is as follows. Maya Jacobson-Zaracki is going to talk about her business that she started, which was a second career after kind of working in finance. We'll let her tell that story so I don't screw that up. But she has a company now called Feed Your Soul Cookies. So holidays coming up. Listen up. We can do some good, buy some cookies, do well, eat well, all at the same time. Then I've got Chef Ivy Stark coming in. Ivy is a badass. I love her. She's so cool. OG, has been in New York for a long time, working in great restaurants. One of a lot of women chefs leading New York kitchens and America's kitchens these days. And she's really got a hell of a job. She's the executive chef for Dos Caminos, all of them. So if you don't know Dos Caminos, it's a Mexican restaurant, or I should say a group of Mexican restaurants. They do tons of volume. The food's great. Ivy's going to talk about her business, how she does it, and how she got to where she is today. And my last guest, because we got to talk about wine, I think, once every one of these, every show, it seems, we have a somm out, right? We have Risto. Risto Zazovsky, who's an old friend. He's great. He is the beverage director / head sommelier for all of Michael White's restaurants. And as you know, if you know anything about Michael White and the Alta Maria Group, I've lost count on how many restaurants they have in Manhattan. 7, 8, 9, I don't know. And that's just the Manhattan stuff. Then there's London, Dubai, Hong Kong. Yeah, it's like that. He's so cool. So we're going to pour some French wines. We're going to talk about one of his newest restaurants. I think it's the newest Michael White restaurant. He's known very well for his Italian food in the city. That's kind of been his niche. And then he's kind of went Provence with Ifury. And now he's doing French with Vaucluse. So we're going to pour French juice. Yay. All right. My first guest, Maya Jacobson-Zaracki. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So, tell me. You were in finance. You tell the story. Because it's kind of cool. You had this whole career where you were in finance.
Yep. I was a Wall Street trader. I was one of the few female market makers on the American Stock Exchange. I literally stood on a box and somehow I ended up in one of the most volatile crowds on the floor. I stood on that box and traded for about 7 years. And,
which is kind of exciting stuff.
It was exciting.
On the floor,
I definitely saw
all
some
that testosterone,
and
all that energy.
A lot of testosterone.
Right. I mean, it's kind of what we think of in the great movie scenes and all the, you know.
It was. There's a lot of practical jokes played. Saw a lot of bets, a lot of body parts, a lot of things that I don't care to always discuss. But it was a wonderful experience. But same time, I think I was looking for something more meaningful. It was post September 11th. I think things changed with a lot of people at that point. And I was looking to do something more meaningful. So set up an LLC, set up a UPS account, and a website. And
you were baking out of your apartment.
Well, I actually started this, which I will say, I was looking to do something that represented the things in life that feed your soul, which to me was inspirational words, giving to those with less, and food. I think there's something nurturing and timeless about feeding people. I was more of a food person than a baker, to be honest. But I thought that from my business side, there were good profit margins in cookies. It was a shippable item. And so literally, if you ordered on Monday, you had a different chocolate chip cookie than on Wednesday. And I just started churning out product out of my apartment. UPS was wheeling hundreds of packages down the hall, and orders started pouring in. So I became this great cookie company.
How did you get the word out initially? Because if you're talking about like 2000... One, two, like that's is, kind of, isn't that like pre-social media, or am I just getting really old?
Yeah, no, it was pre-social media.
Right, so there's no Instagram then, there's no
nothing.
Twitter then.
I didn't even use Facebook.
Was probably an idea in someone's head,
no,
right?
You're
Zuckerberg.
Right, you're right. So
how did you get it? How'd you do that?
Well, aside from the fact that I probably had more energy then than I have now, I was very good at pounding the pavement. I had myself in supermarkets, cafes, gyms. I was in bars. I was anywhere that someone was willing to take my product. I was also able to, I guess, create an idea that people liked, and it resonated with people. So we were able to get a bit of press, and that it just
kind
of snowballed.
Kind of effect, like this, a natural, organic way of a business to grow.
Yeah, and while I was still a small company, compared to the fact that I was baking out of a studio apartment, it was big. I had four mixers going. I was buying my ingredients at BJ's and Costco, and you know, thankfully, we've come a long way.
And it was like Jersey City or something, right?
This was Hoboken.
Hoboken, right, that side of the Hudson.
Apartment.
Right,
yeah. My UPS driver would sit there, check
your oven
emails.
Was on constantly. You should only put half sheet pans in ovens.
And I was a renter, bake. Yeah. So the people in the building weren't happy, but...
What? Whatever.
I had a tins packaging. They would bring it on flatbed trucks. I'd have to, you know, they're looking for my loading dock. I'd say apartment 5B, please. And I'd tip them and they'd bring the stuff.
Hysterical. Up. So talk about the premise of the business, okay. Because it is this sort of, there's this beneficence to what you do, which is why you're here. Because honestly, if you were just like another somebody at the fancy food show
that's
hawking the next biscotti, the next brownie, mm-hmm. the next tortilla chip, I'm like, you know what? That's somebody else's show. So right. Talk about what you do.
Okay, well...
The premise behind it and how it sort of feeds your soul and does good stuff.
Sure. Well, to be honest, the cookies have done well. And, you know, we do constantly invent new flavor profiles, although we still have the standards that people love. But the idea is really that the cookies serve as a vehicle to do some good. And there's always been a charitable component. But the idea that we're going with is we have a page on the website called Pay It Forward, for example. And if you order any item on that page, you will receive a free 6-piece gift box, which either comes to you or comes to your recipient, comes with instructions so they understand what it is. And you can literally give that gift to somebody else, whether it's a neighbor, a mailman, anybody that's important to you or someone that just needs to have a brighter day. Hmm. You can hand them a box of cookies. And it's just kind of doing some good in such a simple way, and it matters.
Where are you doing the baking now? Where's the commissary?
Well, we have a commissary in Jersey City, and we are actually expanding to a brand new commissary January 1st in Kearney, New Jersey.
Kearney.
So we have
scenic
a new
Kearney
Point, but there is a new industrial park that is being built, and all entrepreneurs, larger businesses that are doing shipping, there's a lot of exciting things happening there, and they're creating a community it's a work environment.
How many employees do you have now?
Right now, I have 5 employees, and you know, unfortunately or fortunately, a lot of what I do is automated, so we've really scaled up with machinery. You know, that was a struggle from the beginning, too, being a boutique business and, you know, following the demand of the product and the quality in the small batches and keeping that, but yet still being able to mass produce on a level where you're growing your business.
And, but at the end of the day, dough still is mixed. I mean, maybe you're mixing bowls, or instead of that little KitchenAid, you've got a 60-quart Hobart.
But there is a science to it, as I'm sure you know.
Yes, there is. I don't bake. You know, I hate baking.
But there's only certain things you can do without changing the quality of the product.
Correct.
So we're trying to stay true to the quality.
So still relatively small batch. Now, where could we find? So give us the website.
Okay, so the
online
website
presence.
Yep, the website is feedyoursoulbakery.com.
Okay.
We do have a wholesale distribution line of products. Probably the most local one would be Chopped Salad. You could go into a Chopped Salad chain
and
try
our product.
Oh, you sell
them. Okay, they've grown a lot.
We do a lot of, you know... we do a lot of hotels. Some things are private label and corporate. We do a lot of developers. So companies will buy tins of cookies for every new tenant saying, welcome to your new home. Mm. And that's huge for us because cookies represent home.
So you've been, so this is like 13, 14 years?
It's 10 years. It's 10 kind of real years. You know, the beginning, we count it, but it's more comical than anything else. We always say we're going to look back and laugh. And
every year growth.
Every year we're growing. We've been very fortunate. We're growing. You know, like any business, you make some mistakes along the way, and we've been fortunate enough to survive it. We used to do some supermarkets. We stopped doing the supermarkets because we don't have a shelf-stable product, and it was hard to have our product competing and sitting on a shelf. There's a business side to that.
People don't realize there's that huge lag when you're selling supermarkets of distribution, of getting it there. Yep. It's sitting in the back of the, you know. And then, yeah, you're competing. I mean, you think about what's on supermarket shelves.
And we don't have preservatives.
It's Pillsbury. It's Entenmann's. Right. It's just stuff that's expiration dates like the next century.
And it's hard to compete with the prices of some of those, but we're using real butter, we're using real vanilla, we're using real eggs, and we can't compete with those prices. So.
Yeah, but it's great to see. I mean, it's great to see that does well, and I think that that's kind of like a new thing. I've known some great pastry chefs over the year because I was a chef and, you know, pastry chefs, and I remember like back in the 80s and 90s, some of the guys I used to work with that were pastry chefs, Europeans, saying, you know, I want to open up my own retail store, and I'm like, don't. Don't, because Americans then, there just wasn't enough support for retail because, you know, we were so used to the idea of buying Entenmann's for $2 for this 1 pound.
That's right.
Kind of partially cooked, fully preserved, horribly sweet piece of shit. And people are like, why should I pay, you know, $1.50 or $2 for your wonderful little thing that's stale tomorrow when I can buy cupcakes and Twinkies and Entenmann's and it lasts like a month?
Right. But people, I feel like things are going that direction.
It's totally changed. It's really, really
people
changed.
People care about what they eat. People care about what they buy. And I think that's why, you know, this is not a marketing ploy to do the pay it forward. It's the core of what Feed Your Soul is, and it's why I started it in the first place.
Is anybody else in the food space doing what you're doing? Is there a similar model that someone else is doing?
Honestly, I've gotten that it's more like Tom's Shoes than anything else.
Yeah, I had mentioned that, but I don't know what Tom's Shoes is because I wear Pumas.
Let us be an edible Tom's Shoes. It's the idea of one for one. They did the whole one for one. You know, for everything you buy, every shoe you buy, they give one to someone in need. We're actually doing a one for one, but in real lifetime. You know, you get a package, you get to give something to someone you choose.
It's a great gift idea. So shoot out for me one more time the website.
Sure. It's feedyoursoulbakery.com.
Bingo. So if you're looking for holiday gifts as we come into this holiday gifting season with Thanksgiving like around the corner, I can't believe it already. I know. I've got a theory of life. This is my theory of life. It's very scientific. That picture a long playing record. Remember LPs? I still spin vinyl. Vinyl's making a comeback too.
Yeah.
So that's cool. All the hipsters are into vinyl. Like turn, and I'm like so glad I didn't throw away my like 3,000 record collection. But here's when you're really young, it's like the outside of the record where like summer when you're 10 years old lasts like 3 years, it seems. Like when you're a kid, a day lasts a month. And then the older you get to the middle of that record and then you start to get towards the end and it's like zing, zing, zing. That's what I think. I have this horrible theory that that's what's happening, that we're all like LP records, and as you hit like a certain age, you're like in the middle, and then towards the end, and then right tick tick. I don't want to know about that part.
Yeah, that's
but
funny.
Yeah, so yeah, this year flew by. But one more time, shout out for the website. So
yes, it's feedyoursoulbakery.com.
Do good,
and we do have pumpkin pie cookies for Thanksgiving.
Oh my God, pumpkin pie spice cookies? Or
yeah,
pumpkin
they
pie
do. They have spice.
Okay, because that is the thing. Like every day when I open my email, it's like something new from somebody new, like pumpkin pie hot dogs, pumpkin pie spice, hamburger buns. I'm like, oh my God, when will this go away? But you have it. This is
well, you have
just
to
in
have
case.
It. People like it. Yeah,
people like it. It's the thing. It's of the moment.
It's pumpkin pie.
Congratulations. Do you miss stocks? Do you miss trading? Do you miss that shit? No.
I miss the practical jokes once in a while, but we create our own.
Yeah, kitchens are kind of notoriously practical joke places.
They can be, but, you know, we're right. Trying to be held to a higher standard here.
Well, don't laugh. Everybody is. I just got done touring Bouchon Bakery with the baker there, Ali, and she talks about, like, Thomas Keller, like, how they really...
Oh, yeah.
Like, that business is, like, so up and up, and the kitchens I worked in versus kitchens that's totally changed. Like,
it's pristine.
We'd be in jail for the shit that we did.
That's
forget
right.
About getting fired. We would be, like, doing time in New York for the shit that went on back in the day. Keep it up. I don't know what she's trying to tell you. Keep it up. Keep it up. Great work. Feed Your Soul Cookies.
Thank you.
Blah, blah. And so go to the website. Do well. You can
feedyoursoulbakery.com.
Feedyoursoulbakery.com. You can donate to charity. Donate to your friend that's depressed. Donate to your friend that needs help. Your mom who doesn't think you talk to her anymore. There's a million things to do with this. Just think about it. Thanks. Stay tuned. We're going to go to a quick spot. A couple of people that helped make this show possible by writing checks to us and the station. And you can always do that too, by the way. You can always donate to heritageradio.org or heritageradionetwork.org too. It's a nonprofit. It's great stuff in the holiday season. Think about that if you like this show and any other 50 shows we do. And there's a new show, I'm told, on restaurant dating and sex. Yes, it's called Kitchen Bites or something. I can't wait to listen to that. I don't know. It's supposed to be cool. This will be a cool new show. Anyway, stay tuned. We're going to do a quick spot. Then Ivy Stark is going to come in and talk about Dos Caminos and what she does there. Michael Lameco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Cola Vida family brand for years, and there really is a Cola Vida family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Cola Vida. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Cola Vida family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable source olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Cola Vida's living in Rome, Cola Vida's living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I'd recommend you try it as well. So if you listen to the show, you know I am a wine lover. We get sommeliers here all the time. We get winemakers. I've been drinking wine with dinner since before most of you were born. And when you think of the great wine regions of the world, I mean, what comes to mind? Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, Piedmont? Yeah, okay. Well, I just got back from Bordeaux. Was there for the crush for the 2015 harvest. And I was thrilled to see, A, how the city of Bordeaux has transformed itself. It's so alive. It's so beautiful. And the region itself is crazy. There's a whole new generation of young vignerons were coming in, and they're not making your grandfather's Bordeaux anymore. Young farmers, young vignerons that have been there for generations, that know the soil, that know the grapes. And what grapes are we talking about? You know, we're pretty familiar here. Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot, Malbec, all of those grapes find themselves in these blends. But the new style of Bordeaux wines are super fresh, super young, super clean, meant to be consumed now, not cellared for decades, because really, who has a cellar? The whites are super great. I think they're super undervalued and appreciated. Semillon, Sauvignon Blanc, crisp, dry, all stainless. If there's a little oak integration, you barely feel it. And the reds come in all sorts of styles. You know, the left bank is a little more Cabernet Sauvignon heavy, a little more structured, a little more tannic. The right bank with more Merlot tends to be fruity, a little more opened up, receives you a little bit easier. But if you've been walking past that Bordeaux aisle in your wine store, stop and grab a bottle. From $15 to $35 is some of the best value on planet Earth with wines that are growing in one of the great wine regions, vignerons that are passionate, they know what they're doing. Give Bordeaux a second shot. I love the wines. I do actually love the wines. I do, but I'm trying to drink more American juice. I'm trying, but I've got Risto here in a little bit, and Risto brought some juice from one of my favorite places. I don't know where he brought it from, but I'm assuming it's French because Vaucluse will be the topic. But first and foremost, Ivy Stark, how cool. So I've known, like, your name, because you've been, you know, you're like a high-profile chef in this business.
Thank you.
But what I didn't know, because we met for the first time, it's funny. Have you done the Share event before? Because I used to do lots.
I've done the Share event since the first event.
See, which that's embarrassing, because I've been to it a couple times. I was doing the show on WOR. Mm-hmm. We would always go and have guests on, and then I would go. And because I know so many of the women who are in the industry. I mean, I've been here a long, long time, so I've watched the whole scene change.
Well, it's a busy, crowded event, and
correct.
There's lots of people to
correct.
Talk to.
Correct. It's a big room that gets bigger every year.
Yes.
Congratulations. It's so cool. We had a couple of chefs. couple of weeks ago. Post, because that was in September, and my show doesn't start until October. Mm-hmm. We talked about that and talked about next year, but talk about your background. It's so cool, because what I didn't realize was the sort of history you have in the New York restaurant scene. So, before you get to that, what got, I ask everybody this question the first time I meet them, no matter who they are. What drew you into this business? Because it's such a funny business.
Well, I mean, that's a little bit hard to say because my father's in the hotel business. So my first job was, you know, washing dishes and bussing tables when I was about 14. And I didn't really like it then. And I did it all through college. Then you get thrown on the pantry station and you learn
more.
Right.
Somebody calls in sick and you're like, hey, kid, put an apron on.
Exactly. And then I went to college. I studied history in school and was kind of being pushed to go to law school. And then I went to Europe and you know how seductive that is with all the amazing food and wine and everything. And I was like, I need to just stay in the restaurant business because I cooked through school and I love it. Why would I want to change and be a lawyer?
Right, which is right, because most lawyers I know hate it. I mean, it's like one of the most unhappiest professions.
Exactly. I'm very grateful that I made that decision.
Well, so Alice Waters, same epiphany. I mean, Alice Waters was this sort of shiksa from Chatham, New Jersey. They grew up eating like overcooked lamb chops and boiled vegetables.
And she goes
to France and like eats her first bloody oyster on a half shell and a baguette with really good butter and goes like, holy mother of God, like this is food?
It was a revelation. Yeah. I had no idea. I mean, I grew up in Colorado. We didn't even have fresh produce, practically. You know, we had some cabbage.
So, no cooking school?
I did go to what was Peter Kump's at the time.
Oh, okay, Peter Kump. That's when Peter Kump was around.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember he was in the dining room once when I was eating at Luca Carton way, way back in the day when Ellen Sondrens had moved from Orchestrat to Luca Carton, and I thought, wow, that's Peter Kump.
Yeah.
So who's the guy speaking English over there? Seems to know his shit. And they're like, oh, that's Peter Kump. I'm like, we're sending wine back and forth. So you did some cooking school, and then your early New York days were where? You were Sign of the Dove.
Sign of the Dove, yes, with Andy D'Amico.
Which was back in the day. This is like the old New York days. So this is the 80s. It's a 3-star restaurant.
Upper East Side. Yes. Very, very different cooking world than we're in now.
Yes.
You know, I miss it in some ways and don't in others. I used to sometimes wake up in the morning and cry while I was waiting for the shower to get hot because I knew what was in store for me.
Yeah.
But I learned so much there, and I look back, like, I loved it so much. Just the energy and the...
And you have been, so if you don't mind, this is such an embarrassing question, but you were on the hotline there.
Yes, I was a sous chef.
Any other women on the hotline there?
No.
No, because, I don't want to calendar year. We're talking about late 80s?
Yes.
I mean, the deal was back then. So Andy D'Amico was an American kid, and that restaurant was owned by a guy who was a dentist, I think.
Dr. Santos.
Dr. Santos, that's correct. And it was a 3-star New York Times restaurant. I mean, it was a destination. It was sold out, booked out a month ahead, considered one of the great restaurants, Upper East Side neighborhood, back when the Upper East Side was the place people wanted to live, like, by choice.
Yes.
Not because it's the cheapest place in Manhattan, as it turned out. I mean, not the cheap, but, you know, now there's like now it's like the bargain place, because nobody wanted to live in Alphabet City or the Lower East Side then. But I'm digressing. Shut up, Michael. But the point was that, like, if you, as a woman, if you went to the restaurants, if you'd gone to Lutèce, Le Cote Basque, Le Caravelle, Maurice,
no way.
Pastry or Garmanger.
Yes.
There were no women on the hotline anywhere in New York.
No, I've been really, really lucky that there have been certain people in my career that have given me a shot, and Andy was one of them, and, you know, clearly more open-minded than many others. He was a very old school type chef then.
Mm-hmm.
I know he's softened up quite a bit. Now I tease him when I run into him. I'm like, I'm still scared of you.
Yeah, we all had. We had to. I mean, the days of running kitchens like maniacs.
It was like crazy, but it was so much fun. In retrospect, it was really a lot of fun.
And also like the women in the kitchen, like Sally Dar had La Tulipe, Leslie Revson. Anne Rosenzweig was just not even kind of on the radar yet. I mean, that was it. There was like three other women that were sort of out in front. All right. So it's crazy how much that's changed. So after Sign of the Dove, where?
After Sign of the Dove closed, and I went to work at Cena, which was also a 3-star restaurant.
Yes, I remember the Canadian guy. And
Norman Laprise.
And it was owned by the couple, Stephen Thalia.
Yes, exactly.
As Zoe.
Also an incredible learning experience.
They were pros. Both of them were great.
Service-wise and food-wise, beautiful food. And, you know, it didn't last, unfortunately. It was a little ahead of its time for that neighborhood, I think.
Yeah, New York's It's funny. I mean, the whole restaurant casualty thing is inexplicable. So this super solid resume, and again, one of the really early women pioneers in the business, because you got on the hotline, which is just like, for some reason, that wasn't allowed. And I don't know when, maybe till the 90s or a little bit later, that it was sort of like we had to get rid of, not get rid of, but those older European guys kind of had to retire. And then new American guys, you know, the Charlie Palmers of the world, the French, who sort of took over, just had a different paradigm.
Right.
Then it was different. Then it was okay. We know the old rules are gone. Dos Caminos, talk to me about this, because how many do you have in New York?
We have 5 now in New York.
You just opened a new one in Times Square.
Yes.
Which seats how many people?
It seats about 225 people.
In bloody Times Square.
In bloody Times Square.
So you're in the theater district, you're in the prime tourist district. On a Saturday night there, you're going to do, drum roll,
600 covers, probably.
Fuck, that's a lot of avocados.
It's a ton of avocados. But it's fun. It's so much fun. And there's actually a lot of business around there. So we're getting a lot of business people for lunch, too. So it's we have a combination of the tourists and a lot of suits as well.
So you would work the connection for you and Dos Caminos was you worked for the two women that had the hot pepper chili.
Two
hot tamales. Then again, pioneers, early days of the Food Network, when they actually wanted chefs who were legitimate chefs as hosts.
Yes.
Not like bobbleheaded idiot fake chefs.
Right.
Like most of what they have for the last 15 years. And you worked for them out on the West Coast.
Yes, I did. Well, I did my culinary externship with them. And interestingly enough, the pastry chef there had her baby prematurely, and they put me in pastry because I was the only one who had gone to cooking school. They're like, you went to cooking school, you do the pastry.
Oh, no. I went to cooking school, and you don't want me doing your pastry, let me tell you. But you came up to speed. You did it.
Yeah, I did it for 3 months. And then at the end of the time, they said, well, do you want to stay in pastry? And I was like, heck no. Get me back in the kitchen.
That's so funny. Really? Because I think of pastry. Like, you know, pastry in a place that can allow it, that has like a separate kind of pastry kitchen. It's usually like an oasis of calm and cool, and it's not as, but you wanted hotline. That's, you like that energy.
The energy.
Okay.
The adrenaline.
Yeah, it's totally different feeling. Because it's a la carte, and it's a totally different setup.
Yes.
My pastry's like mise en place, put it all together, do the timing, put it in the oven, timer goes off, take it out. But it's not that same, although there's an a la carte pastry station these days.
Yes.
But a lot of the prep is much calmer, whereas the hotline's just like at 5:30. When that Michaels machine starts kicking out dupes, it's showtime.
Yeah, it is showtime. There's nothing better. And also, I don't like to get up early in the morning.
Me neither.
You have to do that for pastry.
We talked about that. Me neither. I don't like getting up. Or I never do. I still like whatever.
I haven't since
I don't like
I was
eating during the day. Yeah. It's like this whole, you become like a vampire in your brain in the restaurant business.
Absolutely.
So that was the connection. That's sort of what's got you into that sort of Mexican or Southwestern or Mexican food. And then how did you get like the dose in the initial gig? How did it come up?
Well,
Steve Hansen owned it.
Yeah, Steve Hansen owned it, and he brought aboard.
And a lot of other things. He's a player.
Yes. Scott Lindquist, who was the original chef at Dos Caminos, worked with me at Border Grill in Los Angeles, and we're still extremely good friends. And they were opening up the Soho location. And
the original one, Soho, the one I ate at the other day.
Well, the Park Avenue was the first, and Soho opened about 6 months later.
West Broadway.
So he brought me on to open the Soho location, and that's how I ended up there. And, Scott we worked together for 6 or 7 years, and he moved on. He's opened his own place in Miami, and Steve gave me the opportunity to oversee all of the restaurants, which has been tremendous.
And Steve Hansen, like, for those of you that don't know, he's like one of these kind of Wizard of Oz kind of guys. I think I just personality-wise a little differentiation. I mean, like Jeffrey Chodorow comes to mind, too.
Yes.
Jeffrey's a big player.
Yes.
So Steve's one of these guys. Like, we all know about Drew Nieperant. We all know about Danny, because Danny's and Drew both opened up in 87, Modern State Union Square Cafe.
Yes.
What Danny did for the whole 14th Street neighborhood and Drew did to Tribeca is legendary. These guys are empresarios. But a little less visible were guys like Steve Hansen, who worked with Alan Stillman. And Alan Stillman's the guy who started out with the original TGI Fridays, which is in Manhattan.
Yes.
Then had a place called Thursdays and Wednesdays, and his partner was Ben Benson.
Mm-hmm.
Then they opened the first Smith and Wolensky. Like, I mean, this is like legendary. So the guy opens up TGI Fridays, it franchises it out, sells it, makes a bundle. Then he opens up the first Smith and Wolensky franchise. Well, owns out. Actually, wasn't a fan. Owns them all. Opens up everywhere, makes a fortune. But he couldn't sell the New York one because Ben still had a piece of it. And Ben didn't want to. Ben said, I didn't want to go south of 34th Street. Ben's hysterical. But so the, so Steve Hansen works for Alan Stillman, and like, what a great, that's like the Yale Graduate School of restaurants. Because Steve,
exactly,
in his prime, at his peak, had so many successful restaurants that we know of in the city.
Well, and look at how many people sort of studied under Steve, me included.
Yeah.
I certainly wouldn't have the knowledge of the finances of a restaurant, right, and the mechanics of service and just how lighting affects the, you know, he's was a genius at detail, and I really learned a lot working there, and many have. And in fact, your next guest works with Michael White, who
correct,
I used to work with.
And Michael White came up through Fiamma.
Yes.
And that was Steve Hansen's best restaurant. It was a restaurant that I was. It was really, that was fine dining.
Yes, absolutely.
And that was Michael White's entry to New York City. That was the gateway.
That was it.
Yeah, and Fiamma was great. Now it's Costada, his steakhouse.
Yes.
So what's it like? Like, what's a day in the life like? Because you're running five restaurants. I mean, mm-hmm, Park Avenue South is a shit. I mean, all those restaurants on Park Avenue South, a lot of seats, crushing volume.
Yes.
And it's casual, and you're kind of encouraging that, like, have, mm-hmm, you know, do the margarita thing, whatever, have some shots of mezcal, some tequila.
Absolutely.
And let's go. And
that's why they come to us.
Order
that's
food and
want,
have fun. So you're back and forth. What's a day? What's a day in your life? Just sort of like a snapshot.
Well, a typical day, like, you know, I would have a meeting like this morning in the corporate office in the morning, and then I would go to one restaurant or another for lunch service. Today it was Dos Caminos Park Avenue. I had a meeting this afternoon with my executive chefs. I have executive chefs in each location, and we get along. We have a great team, and I have some people that one of the guys that's our executive chef at Park Avenue was a line cook with me at Dos Soho, and you know
came up through the ranks,
and several of them have, and they're just an amazing, amazing team. So we have a really fun meeting. Usually we cook. We'll pick a region of Mexico or a subject. Like, you know, this week was apples, actually. And they just have to come up with a crazy whatever dish they want to based on apples. Mm. So we get to do a little creative work. We get to do a little of the not as fun meeting stuff.
Yeah, the food costy stuff, the labor costy stuff, the usual. But that's the business. Honestly, when you lift the hood of a restaurant,
yes,
that's what you find.
Exactly.
Like it or not, it's not all about...
Well, it's a business, but...
Yes, which chefs, we are our worst enemies that way. I mean, it's a business.
Yes.
It's supposed to make money.
Yes.
Right, and chefs are like the biggest knuckleheads that way. It's about the food. Yeah, okay. It's true, but it's about the service. And I hate to say it, it's probably more about the front of the house, the lighting, the I mean, food has to be there, but...
It's all part of it, but, you know, we want to bring them back with the great food time and time again, and we talk about consistency all the time.
That's what my next question. Talk about that, mm-hmm, because you're, I mean, it's hard to be consistent in a single restaurant from night to night. I was always one of the challenges I felt as a line cook coming up, and mm-hmm, the chefs wouldn't, like, Michael, you know, here's the standard where we want you, and you have to hit it every day, all night long. We don't want
right,
deviation. We're not big on deviation.
Right. Well, part of it is that the chefs have all been trained. All of them were sous chefs, so they had all had some training before they became the executive chef, and they know the food inside and out, like every station, every dish, and they have all worked at all the restaurants. We rotate them around a lot, so the consistency is maintained in that way. And then there are other ways. You know, we have a lot of little controls for as far as like portioning goes. So, you know, you use this spoon to scoop the whatever onto the plate, and
which
it's
you need to for
spoon,
everything for food,
yes,
costs. So people come, you know, they come on a Saturday night and they love it, and they want to come back 3 weeks
they
later.
Want it
Tuesday.
To be exactly
it has
the
to
same.
Be the exact same thing.
Yep.
Yeah, that's one of the hardest things to do in the business. Do you get to travel to Mexico much on research and development?
I go once a year. I just took one of my chefs. We went to Oaxaca for a week with Susana Trilling, and we studied, and we ate, and we drank, and we had an amazing time and brought a lot of stuff back.
Talk about one thing, like, because that's the, I mean, I know as a young, like, line cook / sous chef, and then mm-hmm, at some point became an executive chef. But, you know, in that period, we would always go to France, and mm-hmm, sometimes we'd stage, but we'd eat out all the time. Any disposable income we had during the year was spent in like 3-star, 2-star
yes,
restaurants, because we just had to. And I've those notebooks full of like pictures that we would draw of the plates in there. But
I have all of my notebooks.
And you
notebooks.
Come home with this bon bagage of like,
yeah,
you couldn't wait to cook. You'd be on the
yes,
plane home like, it's the craziest thing because we're nuts. We're chefs. We're just out of our... So you go to Mexico and you have that same thing. You're getting
yes,
stoked. You're seeing new stuff. So tell me something that you took home from that. That's
well,
finest way to the menu.
Well, a really, really great dish. The beautiful thing about Mexico is you can go there a million times and see something brand new every time. So I saw this dish that was, it's called, they're called tetelas, which means triangle. de Huxtlahuaca, which is a little village in Oaxaca, which is the only place they make these things. And it's a corn masa triangle that's filled with this spicy red bean paste and griddled and then served, you know, with a salsa. And they were just amazing, unique, very just so Oaxacan and so Mexican. And I immediately came back and put them on a menu for a mezcal dinner that we did with great success. And it's also on our holiday hors d'oeuvre menu now. So, you know, I knew as soon as I saw it being made and tried it, I was like, I have to do this in New York.
So great to meet you.
Thank you.
Get you back on again at some point. Ivy Stark has been my guest. She's the chef at all of the, and is there, you had a Vegas one and you closed it?
Yes.
Yeah, because I remember those Vegas ones. So five in New York City, Park Avenue South, Soho, Meatpacking District, Times Square, and
Midtown East, 50th and 3rd.
Okay, congratulations.
Thank you. I mean,
you're great. You got a great story. You got great. You still love the business.
It was a pleasure talking about the old days. I don't have many people that I get to talk to about that stuff with anymore.
No, it's so great. Before I met you the other night, I was like, let me go online, and I'm like, dude, wow. That's the time. Yeah. I remember. It was so different. It was such a different time in New York. It's way better now.
Yeah.
Way better now. The food's, I mean, the food scene's just the food along. Scenes. The ingredients
incredible.
Are great. I know.
Ingredients.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Ivy Stark, chef extraordinaire, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. Risto Zizovsky is going to be with me, and we are going to be pouring some French wines, I'm assuming, and talk about Michael White's latest restaurant, Vaucluse, Upper East Side, New York City, right after this.
This is the story of men and women who shed not only their clothes, but also their...
Hey, this is Michael Harlan Turkel from The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. You know, every Tuesday at 3 p.m., I stop in the studio, walk to the far side, sit in my favorite blue chair. If you ever stop by Roberta's, look through the window, and you can see that chair itself. You know, and I've been sitting here for 5-plus years, 250 episodes, have met some of the best people in the food world, such great culinary minds. And recently we just relaunched our website, added a whole bunch of shows, but we still need you, our listeners, our friends, our fans, even guests themselves, to help us out. We you know, we're a 501c3, a nonprofit, and we're not really doing this for the money. We're doing this for the love, for the greater good of the food world as a whole. So get on heritageradionetwork.org, click that little pounding heart in the top right corner, and, you know, give what you can, or just keep on listening. We'd love to have you.
Welcome back. Food Talk. Mike Colomeco. It's still here. We haven't gone away yet. And that's good news. Wow, I smell this from here already. Holy snarf, blood. You're going to have 10 minutes on drinking. My guest, and he's been here before, Risto Zizovsky. Risto cut his teeth on the floor at John George.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken.
In March Restaurant.
Yes. And then you got this great gig being the beverage director / head somm. Is that what the title?
Yeah, I'm the beverage director for Altamirea Group.
Altamirea Group, which is just like, Altamirea Group has been, if not the most successful, certainly one of the most successful restaurant operations with multiple locations in the last decade. Originally Michael White and Chris Cannon, no longer is Chris involved. Michael White and one investor. And how many restaurants in Manhattan now?
I think 8.
Right. I was trying to say in the setup. Michael came originally with Fiamma, which wasn't his restaurant. That's where he blew up. He got a great 3-star review, got on everybody's radar. I think the restaurant that was really the tipping point was Marea.
Yep.
Because
Marea.
It was real super fine dining, on Central Park South, the old San Domenico space, but opened at a time that couldn't have been worse. It was this huge investment in this restaurant that was going triple lux. It's going to be super good. And stock market crashes in 2007, 2006.
Yeah.
Just goes, just implodes.
Yeah.
And that's when the restaurant opened.
Yeah.
And in spite of that, so it's like the worst concept at the worst time.
Yeah. I mean, I remember reading about it when I was at John George across the street. But they were so positive about it. They're like, well, you know, we can buy this marble for 60 cents on the dollar now. And we can buy these beautiful wood and these beautiful pieces and really make the restaurant look beautiful. And we'll take a chance because, I mean, I've been in New York since 2000. So I'm still considered young, but not young. But like, I've seen waves. I've seen like, you know, when I got here in 2000, I heard things like, oh my God, like the dot-com era and people just blowing money on wine and all that. I'm like, cool. Like, I was a waiter. I was like, I want to get into this. This is cool. And that was like obviously one of the things I needed to learn. I didn't know I was going to have such a passion for it, but I needed to learn it if I wanted to be good at my craft. And then 9/11 happened. And then it got back to really good back in 07, 05, 06. Then, in 08, I remember, it just crashed. So, and then the last few years have been pretty good. So, I don't know. Like, that's my 2 cents on it.
But Michael's been really, I mean, as a guy that's kind of become a brand in and of himself.
Yeah.
The consistency of his restaurants is great. I mean, I actually thought iFury was going to be a struggle in a lot of ways because of its location. It's that kind of midtown-y, like it's a transitional place. You're just north of 34th Street. Who lives there? Who goes there? It was in a hotel and it was on the second floor.
Yeah.
So it's like if you could check three boxes of like you didn't want, those would be three.
It was an uphill battle.
And it's big.
Yeah, it was an uphill battle. But, you know, we put our heads down and we did what we do. And yeah, we just celebrated our 5-year anniversary there. Last week was our 5-year anniversary, so it's really exciting.
I think there was a party and I wasn't in town or something.
Yeah, you were invited. It's just great to see that it's just doing great. And
so you oversee this machine of and we didn't even talk about Michael's restaurants out of New York.
Yeah, I oversee all the domestic restaurants. There is a few overseas, but I pretty much just help open them in a consulting aspect. But other than that, I don't know how wine markets are in other places, beverage markets. I can definitely help them start and then help consult seeing what works, what doesn't work. But we hire people there.
Vaucluse. So, I mean, for the most part, Michael's also, when you think of Michael White, you think of Italian food.
Yeah.
Okay. So iFury was more Italian expanding up into Provence.
Yep.
So there's little influences that you'll see of Southern France for sure.
Yeah.
But it's still that same wheelhouse. And remember, a lot of Southern France used to be Italy anyway.
Okay.
But then Vaucluse comes and that's like, wow. So now the guy is doing something different.
Yeah.
Which is French. Mm-hmm. I have yet to eat at the restaurant. It's on my list of things to try. But talk about that wine list, because I mean, otherwise your wine list were kind of curated.
It's
pretty much 80% Italian. I mean, if I go to Morea,
over half Italian,
because
people expect it. But you know, we have. I mean, New York's a great wine culture. So, I mean, yeah, France, Burgundy, U.S. I mean, Fiori's in a hotel, so people, you know, you want to have something for everyone. But this was the first one, like where Osteria Marini is just Italian. I'm like, let's just do French. And of course, they're like, I don't know. And we talk, okay, French and American. Just French and American. But I laid it out as just a French wine list. So if you look at the wine list, it's only written, it's only categorized in French regions. And then at the end of certain regions, like this wine we're drinking right now, which is a Pinot Gris, it's at the end. So like, Burgundy will have all the Pinot Noirs, the Côte d'Or will have all the Pinot Noirs, but then underneath we'll have the California, Oregon, anything American, like stuff from, you know, Michigan, Vermont, stuff like that.
So talk about this wine. Tell me about this wine. Because, look at the color. So I'm looking at this wine, I'm saying, okay, what up? It's Pinot Gris, but so in the glass,
pumpkin-y. Yeah, so I brought French or French-inspired wines. Again, talking about Vaucluse. This is a Pinot Gris from California. It's from an up-and-coming winemaker called Jolie Lade, and it's Pinot Gris. And it's grown in the Sierra foothills, which you don't really see too much. Or you think of California, you think of Napa Valley, Sonoma, Anderson Valley, Santa Barbara now even. But there's these guys, this new wave of like Jolie Lade and like Cruz.
Spell that for me. So
yeah, let me look at the bottles just so I don't mess it up.
No worries.
J-O-L-I-E, and then the second word is L-A-I-D-E. And they're making kind of more just well-balanced wines. Like, this wine was stomped by foot. It's like you said, it's pink because it's Pinot Gris, and Pinot Gris is the same grape as you know, the one in Alsace, the same grape, the one in Italy, and it is a gray grape. Like, if you look at it, you think it's red,
right.
And they stomp it by foot, so it just picks up natural pigment in the color. It's not stripped, it's not filtered, and it's just kind of like, it's pretty,
it's delicious.
It's
man.
Pretty tasty wine.
So what does this go for on the list?
$60.
So you could buy this retail for the in the 30s
if you can find it.
If you can find it. So talk about this, because you know I went this week. I came up on Monday night and just chilled. Tuesday, I went to a little Napa event that Laura Maniac was hosting at Wine Disciples. And I'm trying to. And then Tuesday night, Pascaline had a thing at Manhattan Wine Company, which I love. Pascaline and Loire Valley. I drove up once this summer. Drove up to New York and back to Cape May just to have lunch with her because she was doing a Loire thing. But so I don't drink a lot of New World stuff.
Yeah, no, I understand.
But talk about, like, guys, like, this is interesting movement in California, stuff
yeah.
like this.
So, I mean, the list at Vaucluse is, I mean, we're really, it's if it's American, it's really French influence. So it's like Maya Camus, it's like Hirsch, it's, you know, Sandy, it's Heights, it's Coruscant. It's the ones that have acid. It's the one that's balanced.
Because this had been my criticism of, and I know everyone's throwing their shoes at the radio in America that listens to this, and I've got a lot of wine friends in California, but I mean, when the stereotypical California, you know, cab blends were just too big, too broad, too fruity.
This Pinot Gris is 12.4% alcohol, and it has the fruit. It has I mean, listen, is it geeky? Yeah. Is it for everyone? No. But it has fruit. It's unpretentious. And
it's super fruit friendly.
It's super fruit friendly.
Really nice linear, has that sort of acid and that mineral woven through it the whole way. Real long finish.
I have a theme too going here because this is all stuff I would drink for Thanksgiving as well.
Thank you. Okay, bingo. Thanksgiving. Thank you, because we need themes on these shows.
Yeah. So like last time I was here was for my birthday, so we drank all bubbles. So
it was so good.
So now we're doing all Thanksgiving. So this Pinot Gris, I like Pinot Gris whether it is from Oregon or if it's from Alsace, because I prefer the richer styles. So this is why I brought this, because you think it has like. It has a melon. It has a grapefruit. It has orange blossom thing going on, like Malvasia from Friuli and stuff like that. Like I like a little bit of a richer kind of unctuous white. So that's why I brought this, thinking like if people want things with squash or sweet potatoes or whatnot, this would be like what I would drink.
The one that you just poured now, a Frisian I've been trying to champion for years. We were there for the 2005 harvest, which was a great harvest. The qualities keeps getting better. I'm talking about the Beaujolais region. I'm talking about Gamay as a grape.
Yeah.
This is a classic. So
this, yeah, classic.
Classic producer.
Clos de Rio, 2014. So current vintage. This is their basic wine.
They have a couple ones.
Yeah, and this is, again, unpretentious. People think, oh, I got to drink Burgundy with turkey or whatever. And I'm like, and then people are like, ooh, they're expensive and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, it's a big, you know, obviously, you know, the sommeliers are all behind Beaujolais and Gamay right now. And I tasted some cool stuff in Oregon, some stuff from Michael Engelman poured us some stuff from Australia the other day. Which
I had
like,
one from California that I was just in love with. I bought it at Manhattan Wine Company. Two different vintages. It was just delicious. And the noses. And I had one again last night, two nights ago for dinner at Manhattan Wine at Wine Disciples. It was another domestic Gamay, but it was unmistakable Gamay DNA. Like, there's no way blind tasting you don't get this.
Grown on granite, has that kind of real torched earth thing, but also dense red berries, but it's really doesn't have any bite at all. You drink it like it's like easy to go. It's great turkey wine.
Yeah, and I've been drinking it. I don't know what it is with my palate, but I've been drinking. I've been loving these red wines like Ruche, Schiave, Gamay, Grignolino, Nerello Mascalese.
Well, of course, I didn't bring Italian wines today.
No, but you know, these really sort of feminine, fruit forward, all stainless, never see oak.
Yep.
Or if they do, you don't know it's old oak or a bigger format. I just love those wines because they're so, like, Gamay is so fruit friendly. This wine you could drink with all kinds of fish.
Oh, you can drink
all
it
kinds
with
of meat. You have it with steak, chicken, pork. I mean, it's like one of the most versatile pairings.
Yeah. No, it's definitely. I mean, we range most of our wines by the glass, from lightest to heaviest. So we pour this by the glass right now. We have the other this label at Vaucluse, but this is from Ristorante Marini, and this is like our first glass on the list.
I have it at home. I love this wine. What's the last one? And by the way, the restaurant Vaucluse, the name Vaucluse comes from. It is a Rhone region.
It's basically a state in the southern part of France. So okay. It encompasses
southern Rhone. Excuse me.
Well, it encompasses basically Chateauneuf-du-Pape in the north and goes down to Provence.
Okay.
So, and you know, of course, you got to start somewhere opening a restaurant and whatnot. But we decided. I mean, the menu there is just classic French.
Like, it looks it.
It's not tweezers. It's not like molecular or anything. It's old school. Cooking techniques, Chef Jared and Chef MW are just, I mean, again, when we did you don't know what to expect. You know when a chef makes a menu, you see it, but then you don't have it until like the day before you open in a way. And when it was like, it was just, it's pretty delicious.
And it's so nice.
I'm really just happy. I was really proud of
it. It's so nice to see French food kind of coming back because I grew up cooking it. So if you were a serious chef in the 70s, 80s, 90s, the great restaurants were French. And you learn French technique in culinary school because you really can't teach Italian because there is no such thing as there's no book. There was no Escoffier. But you know, you see these great French restaurants. I mean, Lafayette's doing a great job.
Yeah.
I think the guys at Battersby and Dover and Brooklyn are doing a great job. Rebel, I was just going to mention. I mean, talk about, we had Patrick here a couple of weeks ago and Brandon. I mean, Rebel's amazing. I remember like going to the first time and I sat at the bar watching the kitchen work and I'm watching them make this sort of variation on like Pommes Maxime. And I'm like, well, fucking shit. These guys are serious.
Yeah.
Seriously.
No, it's really.
Because it's delicious food. It's comforting. It's delicious.
Just like the California wine culture of, you know, trying to make wine like Bordeaux and Burgundy was making back in the 70s and early 80s. I think the French thing is starting to, you know, to step back a little bit. I mean, listen, there's amazing chefs out there that are making crazy awesome things, but this was, I think our vision was kind of like brasserie and make a really good brasserie. I mean, of course the restaurant's beautiful and, you know, we're pretty posh as it is and being on the Upper East Side. But
what's the space? It's where the old Park Avenue, summer, spring, Park the old Avenue, Stillman place. And, it's a gorgeous space.
Yeah, we gutted. Big windows. I mean, the whole thing was completely gutted. So, it's gorgeous.
Been busy?
Yeah, we've been pretty fortunate right now.
Well, has it not gotten reviewed yet?
No, we've only been open for 2 months.
Okay, well, but I'm sure he's been in.
A special guy's been in at least twice.
Yeah, Michael White can't open a restaurant. I mean, it's just too much news.
Yeah.
There's also, you know, the Upper East Side is this funny neighborhood. When I first got to New York in the early 80s, you know, if you had money, that's where you aspired to live. And the great restaurants were in the East 50s, and downtown was no man's land. Now downtown's where everybody wants to be. So the Upper East Side's sort of underserved in terms of really quality restaurants.
There's something for everyone. That's why I look at it.
Yeah. So what? I know the answer to this question, but tell me one more time. What got you into wine? Because it's funny. Your parents had a restaurant? Or?
Yeah. I mean, I can visually remember my very first wine class at CIA. And, I mean, I went right after high school. So I was 18, 19. I graduated like 2 months after a month after my 20th birthday. So, yeah, I didn't really drink wine, but you had to take a wine class your second year. And I remember my instructor laying out, like, I would say maybe 20 wines with like stones in one and pears in another, and like learning, like, okay. And then blind tasting and like just smelling things, reminding me a lot of home, like those memory boxes opening up, you know, my mom's roasted peppers or, you know, candy, like, you know, whatever, Jolly Ranchers or, you know, these boxes that open. And someone told me the other day, and again, everything always comes back to the basics, right? And someone says, I forgot, someone talking about like just being a foodie. People are foodies when they go out and they try different things. People aren't foodies if they just eat macaroni and cheese and hot dogs all the time, right? Because they have nothing to sense their heads in. So it was my first time like putting something in my nose and being like, why does it smell this way? I want to know why it smells this way. I want to know why I get olives in this. I want to know why I get, you know, I want to know why I get the cherries that I only had when I was in Macedonia there. And I want to, like, those kind of things. So, yeah, it's just, it's a fun game.
No, it's so fun. And I'm so glad you mentioned that. You've met my son before. He's moved to New York a couple of years ago. And he goes out to dinner with me at least once a week, sometimes twice a week. Because I'm in town, I'm going out. There's another seat at the table, dude. And he's completely into wine. Like, he spends the guy should be saving money and he's at Flatiron or he's at Chambers. Or he's at this tasting with Pasqualini the other day at Manhattan Wine Club. And he's buying these baller bottles of Cab Franc that you can't get for $50.
You got to cut them off, man.
I'm like, dude, what are you doing this for? What are you doing? like he wants a wine refrigerator. I'm like, just drink what you have. Don't.
Well, that's why I became a sommelier, because
you taste and taste.
I just wanted to get into it and
But what's so fascinating to your comment, what you just said, is we are like every night we're gonna eat dinner tonight at Faro, a couple of blocks from here, and our nose is just in the wine glass. Like, are you getting this? Are you getting that? Are you getting olive? Are you getting jasmine? Are you getting Garrigue? Are you getting this? And it's so amazing, like that phenolic, those phenolic compounds, how they present themselves.
Yeah.
It really is, like, I think winemaking's kind of like alchemy.
Yeah.
It's insane. Because I've tasted grape juice recently. I mean, I've tasted grape juice at the crush, like the grape juice that comes out of literally the crush.
Yeah.
And then I've tasted it in barrels and in stainless steel. And then I taste it finished, and I'm like, how the hell did that become that?
Yeah.
It's like, how did it? It's crazy.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's just... Just, you know, bow your head and enjoy drinking it.
Thank you. It's true, but I keep notes. Like, I have these notebooks that I keep of, like, what I had and what I liked. And then there's like, weak points. I did a tasting somewhere where they gave you those little sniffy things, and I wasn't really good. Like, lemon. There was a specific – I couldn't get lemon.
Yeah.
Actually, I did with Patrick. Patrick Capel was sitting next to me on that one.
Yeah.
And we both got ripe banana, and then they said it was ripe pear, and I'm like, fuck ripe. It's ripe banana. Patrick says it's ripe banana, and I say it's ripe banana. It's ripe banana. It's
not ripe pear. Yeah. It's – listen, it's so – it's so subjective, and if you enjoy it,
that's what matters.
You gotta enjoy it, right. And you gotta spread it that way. You don't spread it because you have to. You spread it because you want to.
What are we drinking here?
So,
what's in this glass?
Again, less wine. I mean, people, you know, want a full body red, and they don't care. They want to drink it. But honestly, what the Northern Rhone has been doing the last few, I mean, maybe for a while, maybe just my palate right now just changing. But this is a Syrah from the Northern Rhone, from Saint Joseph, from Andre Perret.
Which is like God's country.
Yeah.
When you so I think Southern Rhone, you think Grenache.
Yep.
Forward, Northern Rhone, Syrah forward, and then Saint Joseph's like, that's it, bingo, bullseye.
Yeah. So Saint Joseph's one of the old regions.
And Syrah.
Yeah, it's up there with Coroti and Hermitage and Cros Hermitage and Cornas. But, like, again, accessible, not crazy, easy drinking Syrah. Something like I heard one of your ads saying, you don't want to cellar it. Who has cellars? Just drink it. This is it. 2012, current release. Has that meaty, slightly black pepper, that kind of like...
Stewy, gamey.
Yeah, gamey thing going on. But it's also not aggressive on the palate. It has...
Yeah, the tannins recede.
It has weight, but it doesn't have like the crunchiness that some wines that need age need to open up. The tannins are kind of ripe and delicate, but also stern. So,
Ristos, how cool! So, a day in the life. Are you tasting every day? Because you can't be seeing wine. Because that's one of the other challenges for you guys.
Yeah.
Is there's all these wine. There's all those like importers that I want to see Ristos. I want to see Ristos. I want to get my wines on the Altamirea list.
Yeah,
and then you will. You'll allocate a half an hour, 45 minutes from. They come in with that rolling card of 20 wines or 15 wines, and you just taste it. You like become so good at that.
Yeah, it's a balance. I mean, it's a balance. It's one of the things you need to do. It's, you know, you got to taste through a lot of stuff to see what's right, what's missing on the wine list, what's new, what's exciting.
What do you have that's exciting that you've had lately? That's something like curveball that you weren't expecting.
I don't know. That's not a fair question.
Okay, so why do you ask unfair questions?
The thing is, the problem with me is because I have wine directors and sommeliers everywhere that, like, if I find stuff I like, I try to send it to them, but they need to sell at the end of the day. Like,
right.
I'm not really on the floor. So it's a good communication. I try to taste with my psalms if they like it. I mean, what did I taste yesterday? I just posted yesterday on Instagram this new winery, Vera, that's coming from Piedmont. And it said Sauvignon on the label. And I tasted it. I go, this is not like Sauvignon. And I go,
it's like Sauvignon Blanc?
No, it said Sauvignon on the label, right?
Right.
And I tasted it. I'm like, it's not really Sauvignon. It's like salty and weird. I'm like, this is a really bad Sauvignon Blanc. And then he tells me, he's like, no, this is Sauvignon Gris, actually. And I'm like, oh, cool.
Which is a really obscure grape from Bordeaux.
Yeah.
Where they grow on Bordeaux, they don't have to put it on the label.
It's sprinkled everywhere a little bit too. I think I see maybe a little bit in a little bit in Burgundy too. But like after I heard that was Sauvignon Gris, I'm like, that's so effing cool because the wine was good. It just wasn't Sauvignon Blanc.
Right. It wasn't that typical grassy, pyrazine driven.
It was salty and it was like you drank it and wanted to eat something right away. It's like it's like putting peanuts in your mouth and you want something to drink. It was like drinking and wanting food right away. It was like that exact reaction I had.
You're so much fun. One of my favorite memories with you was when I was with a couple of wine geek friends of mine, two girls that are really into the wine business, and we were at Costada, I think.
Yeah, you were at Costada, yeah.
And you were blind tasting everything we did that night, because I always ask you to torture me that way. And you poured a white that you had decanted. And I'm like, okay, all right, it's a white and he's decanting it.
No, that was Bonatti from...
So tell me what the producer was. Tell me who that was. It was a Caricante from Etna.
It was a Caricante 100% from Etna called Bonatti.
B-I-A...
B-E-N-A...
B-E-N-A-T-I,
yeah, just how it sounds, yeah. And they make a couple different whites, but that was their higher end superior.
Fuck.
And
it was just so good. Yeah. And you made it, and we were like, I was just like, oh my god, we're close. One of them got it, I think. One of them got Sicily, and I was like, Falanghina, maybe Greco di Tufa. I couldn't figure it out.
I had a little smokiness,
and you're like you're like getting it, because that's what I was getting. I was getting that smokiness from like volcanic soil. I know, and
look who it is. He's here.
The show's got to end. All right, we have to end the show at some point anyway.
All right.
Tia Keenan, Risto's wife, is here. And the star of the day, Stereo is there. I'm watching this kid grow up on Facebook, and I'm going to watch him now devour a pizza because I've seen him do this before.
He's going to have two himself, yeah.
He's going to have two himself, and he's like 2 years old. All right, a pizza for each year. Risto, thanks so much for coming up. Great to see you. I'm going to hang out with you in the dining room.
Yeah.
Stay tuned next week, folks. We always have great guests. I don't know who they are, but they're booked and we're out of time. So tune in next week. You'll find out. Be well.
For listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.